As I was reminding you at the very beginning of the program, beloved listener, when we came back on air as a live program in late January, Mark Honigsbaum came on to warn us of the emergence of a new virus, and everything Mark said then has come all too true. Mark is a medical historian and journalist, author of the book The Pandemic Century, 100 Years of Panic, Hysteria and Hubris, and it's great to have him back. He's joining us via Skype from London, where last night, of course, Boris Johnson brought in the three-week lockdown on the UK. Welcome back, Mark. Are you in self-isolation?
I am, Philip. Thank you for asking. If you can hear my voice, it's a little bit gravelly. I had sort of symptoms that may be COVID on the weekend, so I'm just keeping very still as instructed, not going anywhere for 7 days.
You made a comment last month that pandemics are always political because they bring up questions about whether administrations have invested sufficiently in health resources. Why does this happen when people have the evidence from the past that millions may die?
Two reasons, Philip. One, as soon as an epidemic or crisis passes, we very quickly forget what happened and move on and bury our heads in the sand. Even while, you know, we can see the crisis unfolding as we were able to see it unfolding in China and then it spread to Italy and Iran, there's just this human sort of kind of reflex almost to deny the evidence before our eyes. I mean, as usual, Albert Camus put it best. We think that, you know, a pandemic is a bad dream, a bogey that will just go away. And I think a lot of people are having that sense now, especially in London and other places, as these extraordinary measures bite. It's like we're walking around in some sort of surreal dream or a movie that we've seen, but it's not quite like those movies because it's happening now in real life.
Global health experts have been saying for years that another pandemic whose speed and severity will rival that of 1918 is going to happen. And now infectious disease experts at just about everywhere, for example, the Francis Crick Institute, were saying, "We told you so." Why didn't Britain listen?
So I think it comes back to that word hubris in my book. I mean, I think the world is getting a massive lesson in hubris or complacency, to put it in plain English. So every country has seen this. In the beginning, Xi Jinping, the president of China, and other officials were complacent about those initial outbreaks, and they didn't want to do anything that would disrupt the New Year celebrations. To their credit, once they realized the scale of the problem, they acted very decisively. The problem is the rest of the world, which was watching, didn't take those lessons on board. And I think the sort of there's a bit of a sort of old colonial attitudes here, like, you know, and certainly in the case of Britain and Boris Johnson, it's the sense that we're different. We're not like China. We'll find our own path. It's not as serious as people are making out. All these sort of very short-sighted ways of thinking came into play. And I think part of it also is that the reluctance to inflict this huge economic damage, which was required to control the virus, that definitely has played a massive role.
I've cited, dear listener, Mark's marvellous book. I also commend to you his piece, his essay in the New York Review, in the most recent issue, I think, Mark. And in it, of course, you make the parallels between now and 1918. Would you like to draw some of those out for me?
Yes, well, certainly. So, I mean, since the epidemic began in China, of course, I've been watching extremely closely. And the first image that really made me start to think, are we seeing a 1918 style event, were those extraordinary images from Wuhan of these hospital waiting rooms that they were constructed almost overnight with these makeshift cots and cubicles for all the overspill patients who couldn't be treated in the emergency rooms. And now we've seen those images also in Italy, and we've seen them in Spain and other parts of the world. And they remind me very much of the first images, most iconic image of all of the 1918 pandemic, which shows American soldiers at a massive training camp. This was during World War One, big training camp in Kansas that was preparing troops for the transports to Europe. And there you saw very similar images of rows and rows of bunks with either sick people or soldiers recovering from recent illness. And that was during the very first wave of the Spanish flu. We know that this virus, the COVID-19 illness, has a very, very similar mortality rate, something like 2% of infected people die. We know that it has a very similar pathology. Those who develop severe pneumonias, as in 1918, get very extensive lung consolidation to the point where they suffocate without breathing apparatus and ventilators to support their breathing. So for those who have severe illness, it's a very distressing illness and it progresses very rapidly, just like the 1918 Spanish flu.
Let me pick up the other main theme in almost everything you've written and said, and that is, isn't it extraordinary that although we've got all this medical technology today, which didn't exist in 1918, our response to it is almost identical?
Yes. We're in the 21st century, but we're being thrown back to 19th century measures. You know, hygiene, washing your hands, social distancing. This is a term that until a few weeks ago, I don't think most Britons had heard of and they couldn't define. Now it's the word on everybody's lips. I mean, this will go down, if nothing else, as the social distancing pandemic. You know, we're being told to keep 2 meters apart, 6 feet, 6 inches apart from strangers in public spaces. In our homes, if we think we have COVID or we've been formally diagnosed, we have to avoid our loved ones for fear of passing the infection to them. And we don't have anything else at the moment. That's what's extraordinary. Of course, we have better intensive care medicine and supportive care than we did in 1918. But just as in 1918, we didn't have enough doctors and nurses, in that case because they were at the front tending to the wounded of Flanders and the other battlefields. Now we simply aren't prepared for a kind of public health crisis because we haven't seen anything like this in over 50 years.
I've been talking to some doctor friends today who point out that as well as those who will die from coronavirus, there will be countless other deaths because other people with other problems, with other illnesses, will be squeezed out of the system.
Yes, and that's tragic. We're being faced with an impossible choice, aren't we? And yet we have to make that choice. I expect many people will be questioning, if you've got advanced cancer or heart disease and require treatment right away, why shouldn't you also get priority? The problem is that doctors are being forced to make these choices every day. It's become something of a lottery. I heard a doctor on the news yesterday talking quite candidly about the fact that, if a young person comes in with COVID, they are going to get priority because the chances of an old person, 80 and over, surviving are slim. So why, frankly, use up or waste that ICU bed when it could go to someone whose life you can save?
Yes, whoever is responsible for the triage faces terrible personal problems, ethical issues.
Yes, I mean, these are difficult ethical issues, but we really have to keep in mind the bigger picture, because you will hear people probably still say, well, you know, isn't this just like a bad flu? Every year we get flu and it kills thousands of elderly people. Why is this different? The reason it's different is that everyone in the world has some immunity to flu, okay? And we also have vaccines against flu. So we know what we can do to control it. And we know that however bad it might be in a particular season, it's not going to be a cataclysm on the scale of 1918. The problem with COVID is nobody has immunity to this disease. And we don't know what the scale of the disaster might be if we don't take these very, very tough actions now.
One of the things that we've got to deal with at the moment, and it's been a significant factor in the spread in my country, are cruise ships. They didn't have those to deal with in 1918.
No, we didn't have cruise ships, but we did see scenes like this on these massive troop transports. So it brings to mind and the famous story of the Leviathan, which was this large American troop transport. In the late summer, I think September of 1918, when we had the second wave of Spanish flu, you saw the most awful scenes where the virus spread from bunk to bunk. Soldiers were confined below decks. And I mean, really, the scenes were like some sort of nightmare. I don't want to describe them for your listeners because they might be squeamish. But we saw basically how rapidly a respiratory virus can travel in the confined environment of a large vessel similar to a cruise ship.
Mark, do you see an antidote, a solution, a magic bullet approaching?
Well, I mean, I'm reading lots of positive things about all the different research. I believe that clinical trials are already starting, and there are hopes that by the end of this year, we might be moving into phase two. So, you know, for those of you who don't know, I mean, vaccine trials, usually phase one is where you just test the principle that the vaccine doesn't cause a worse outcome itself.
Are you there, Mark? Oh, dear, we've lost Mark. And just when we need him badly. But I've been talking to Mark Honigsbaum, British journalist and medical historian, and his book, The Pandemic Century, 100 Years of Panic, Hysteria and Hubris, is published by Norton. I'm very proud of the way the ABC has stepped up to the plate during this time, and I'd like to particularly congratulate my friend and colleague Norman Swan, who has been a voice of sanity, reason and clarity in a time of chaos and confusion. And this, I think, proves yet again that the ABC is a pretty useful organisation to have in times of trouble. It's there for you in drought, it's there for you in bushfires, and it's now there for you with the coronavirus. Oh, I think we've got Mark back. I've got in 1 minute, Mark, what would you be advising my government to be doing now?
Well, I mean, my advice, I mean, I see that you've brought in tougher measures today and advice, but it still seems to me that the problem is that it's all very well restricting businesses and telling people, to avoid congregating in spaces. But I feel like one of the suggestions was, no more going to gyms. You can gather outside and do exercise in groups. 10. Unfortunately, what we're learning about this epidemic is the earlier you bring in stringent social distancing, the better. And that really means no groups above family groups. So 10 people getting together to do stuff in a park still isn't enough, I'm afraid. I mean, we really
have to take extreme measures
to distance ourselves as early as possible.
Mark, thanks for that. That was Mark, and as you can hear, we've got a few communications problems there.